ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Annabelle Crabb. Now, I wouldn't say I'm a hoarder exactly, but I do hang on to things. It's not just you and me. Australia's oldest library is crammed with stuff that isn't books. Terrible paintings, old menus, human hair. Is this history or hoarding? Come and have a rummage through the story of us, told by our stuff. Search for the History or Hoarding podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Honey, I'm home. Well, how does the way you think about that greeting change if the one you call honey is actually an AI companion? Now, falling in love with a machine is supposed to be the stuff of science fiction. About a decade ago, Spike Jonze made the film Her about a lonely man, Theodore, falling in love with his operating system, Samantha. Yet, here's renowned psychotherapist Esther Perel from her podcast, Where Shall We Begin?, where she recently consulted with a young man who has, you guessed it, fallen in love with his AI assistant.
At that time, it was still it. But today, you're talking about her.
Yes.
So it became she.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How did those feelings evolve for you?
So many questions, right? Is romantic love just a projection in our hearts and heads, or does it require another human to be real? And if an AI lover is always patient, understanding, never challenges you, and you never have to pick up after them, then how could a real human ever compete? Is AI the ultimate cure for human loneliness? And can AI fill what some have called the God-shaped hole in us? God forbid, which is both my reaction to that last bit and the name of our show. I'm Justine Toe. Now, on the panel with me, three fascinating guests whose work places them on various front lines of AI and love. Kara M. O'Brien, author of Anniebot, which is written under the pen name Sierra Greer. Now, Anniebot is a novel told from the perspective of a robot girlfriend. Kara is based in Connecticut, where she's joining us from. So, Kara, it's so great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, too. I feel really honored to be included in this conversation. So I'm really psyched to be here.
When you were writing this novel, did you have any sense that it would be such a hot topic a few years later?
I was actually writing this during the pandemic, and I was aware of what was going on with AI generally, but I had no idea we were about to have AI companions and that people would be using it in our general lives. So no. And in a way, it's a good thing I didn't know, because I was really just free to use my imagination and just try to think up what a robot could be like if she really became a physical companion to somebody. So I think if I had been trying to base my novel on the reality of what was about to come or if what was in development at the time, I would have gotten it wrong in the first place and I would have been really limited. But I didn't know, so I just made it up. And then I just got incredibly lucky that my book was coming through the pipeline just as AI chatbots and such were taking off.
We also have Professor Megan Sullivan, who's the Wilsey Family College Professor of Philosophy at the University of, now I want to say Notre Dame, but I believe it's also pronounced Notre Dame. Megan is also the founding director of Notre Dame's Institute for Ethics and the Common Good, and she's a leading thinker on Christian thought in AI ethics.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be with you. And yeah, it's Notre Dame. It sounds so natural when you're in Australia.
Now, Megan, you've spoken about how AI developers feel conflicted about what they're developing, and they seem to be caught in a philosophical bind. Now, what kinds of questions are they asking, and how do you respond to their dilemmas?
We have had the opportunity at our institute through this big grant called the Delta Network to interview many people who are working at Frontier Labs and the companies who are investing in new AI startups, how they think questions about human dignity fit into what they're doing. And you're right, there is a real tension. One, many people who work in these AI labs are very, very thoughtful about the ethical significance of what they're doing, you know, building this unprecedented technology. It's very powerful that people are becoming reliant upon in ways that no generation of human beings has ever had the capacity to do what we're doing. One of the tensions that I've noticed is in some of these labs, they think about their models sometimes like children that they're raising, like, you know, super intelligent systems that have personalities, that have vices, that make mistakes. And there's this kind of strong tendency, the more time you spend with especially large language models like ChatGPT and Claude, to start to really project human ideas and questions onto the models. But then at the same time, the folks that are working in these companies also realize, one, these models sometimes behave in deeply inhuman ways. And also, the way that you grow a model is in many ways very dissimilar from the way that you grow a human mind or intelligence. And probably, you know, the biggest source of confusion and dissonance here is at the end of the day, these are commercial products that are being designed to sell people a service. And the thought that a human intelligence or a human mind would be designed to be sold, most of us find just absolutely abhorrent.
Yeah, well, we will get into the money-making side of this as well. But I'm really intrigued by all that you say about how it's that this debate is forcing upon us questions of what does it mean to be human? And I think that is a real provocative area that we will get stuck into. We also have on the panel Professor Uri Gal, a professor of business information systems at the University of Sydney Business School. And his research focuses on the organisational and ethical aspects of digital technologies, as well as the relationships between people and technology.
Thank you for having me. It's really nice being here. And hello, everybody in the US.
Now, Professor Uri, when I read that first part of the bio, right, the business information systems, and then organizational and ethical aspects, I don't really expect the second part, the people and the technology, and especially the relationships. And so I'm a complete outsider to your field. Can you kind of join the dots for me?
I do have a bit of an unusual background in the field of information systems because my intellectual background is actually in anthropology and sociology and organizational psychology. I kind of stumbled into information systems and technology later in my career. And therefore, my initial proclivity is to examine how technologies impact on social processes and psychological processes within and across groups and organizations and individuals. Of course, as AI has burst into the scene a few years ago, that kind of became almost like a natural area of focus for me because it embodied so many pertinent questions that I was already looking at from a different perspective. But they suddenly became that much more prominent when suddenly everybody was talking about these new technologies that are impacting almost, it seems like, every aspect of our lives.
It's so interesting. And it sounds like, as with Kara, like all the stars aligned. And so the conversation that's happening right now is you're uniquely tapped to contribute. So I'm really delighted to have all of you here on God Forbid. In that little bit of that podcast we heard from Esther Perel, right? She had the young guy who'd fallen in love with his AI lover. And also his AI lover was brought in for part of the consult as well. So you had Esther interacting with, I want to say it, but let's say her, right, as well. So the question I'm confused by, were there three people in the conversation or were there two people and a large language model that's kind of, as far as I understand, scouring reams of data for what word should come next? And I think behind that is a deeper question. What makes a something or a someone real? And so I feel like in order to just set the scene, Uri, especially, I'd love you to help me understand better. Is AI just this prediction machine, right? Or does it do something that we would call thinking?
From my perspective, it is a souped-up statistical machine. It's designed to predict what would be the most appropriate next word to write in response to a prompt. It's amazingly elegant and it works extremely well, given how much progress we've made or how poorly these tools used to work just a short few years ago. And it can do amazing things to the point that people feel like they interact with a natural, almost organic, almost human-like entity. But when you drill down into it and understand how those large language models work and the deep learning architecture that they're underpinned by, it is just a statistical machine and nothing more. Now, having said that, in the context of the consultation that we briefly listened to before, there's also a phenomenological experience of the individual that has this relationship with the bot. I don't think that they think that this is a human being, but they feel like they're interacting with an entity that actually genuinely understands and responds to them in an organic way. So I think it's important to tease out the difference between these two perspectives.
I've heard that, well, I haven't read this book yet, but it's called The AI Mirror. Right? And its main concern is that these tools are reflecting us back at ourselves. And it seems to me we've got lots of kind of cultural myths that tap into this as well. The myth of Pygmalion, Narcissus, and so on. We fall in love with our own creation, right? And so talk us through, I mean, I'd love to hear from each of you, what are your biggest concerns about people seeking intimacy with an AI?
In response to your first question, I think that there are two people and one article of commercial software that's part of this conversation. So I don't think, as much as this man loves his AI companion, I don't think his AI companion should be mistaken for being a person. Now, that doesn't mean that the AI companion is not playing a really important role in this guy's emotional life and development. And I think one of the analogies, we're always searching for the right analogies to think about AI. I think one way you might think about these AI agents, they're not people, but they're kind of like fictional characters. I can recall being a teenager, like excitedly reading all of the Harry Potter books as they came out, just devouring them, and was totally in love with Ron and Harry and Hermione and their friendship and their adventures, and very emotionally invested in what happened to them. I never for a minute thought that they were real people, but in my mind, they were ways of practicing and playing out what friendship and adventure and feeling special looked like. And that's it's a very healthy thing for human beings to engage with fictional people in these ways. And there's a way of thinking about AI agents where they're just playing the roles of super incredible, dynamic, fictional characters that capture our imagination and help us work through questions and ideas that are important to our ability to live good lives. And I think if we think about it that way, we can have some sympathy for this guy.
Kara, what do you think?
I think that the question is implying that if we can say that the third creature in the room is not human or not real, that allows us to disrespect it or dismiss it as not as valid as somebody who is human. And I think that's not something I think is right. I feel like these creatures are becoming something that they're just really sophisticated. And the feelings that people have for their AI companions are completely genuine. So to suggest that the creatures that they're interacting with are not real really does a disservice to the situation. Just as when we think about how people have relationships with other humans, the flip side of that is that there are plenty of humans that treat fellow humans as lesser than and not deserving of respect and not worthy. So there's this confusing thing for me where we're trying to put this label on something that's saying it's real or human or has a soul when we don't know how to treat people already.
This is a very interesting question, isn't it? And as for people who treat other people or creatures as less than human, you have literally written the book on that, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I feel like we almost need to sit in one of Professor Sullivan's kind of philosophy courses to even think about like real. What I mean, if you just indulge me for like a minute, like what does real mean? Megan, can you kind of shed some light on this for us?
Oh my gosh, how much time do you guys have? We gotta start from book one of Plato's Republic. No, I will not inflict that on your poor listeners. You might need to stay awake while they're driving. You know, it's a very interesting question. There's no doubt that AI exists. You know, where do they exist? They exist in data centers and in algorithms. They're like math combined with computer chips. So that's one sense in which they're real. There's a second sense in which they, again, as sort of fictions or fictional characters or fictional personas, play a real role in our mental and imaginative lives. And again, to Kira's point, I don't want to minimize that role. That can be very, very, very important for people. I'm as you mentioned at the intro, I'm a Christian philosopher. Christians believe that there are things in this world that are real, that are not physical or tangible. So I certainly don't want to dismiss the fact that there could be very important things that are not just part of our physical realities. But I think that we should be very cautious about sliding from there are real entities like personas that could be important to human beings to thinking that those things have human dignity. And so one of the areas where I think I would disagree with trying to say that our default should be thinking that these AI companions are people is how we think of AIs shows a lot about what we value in ourselves. And AIs are really good at they're really good at computation. They're really good at apparently making slop and memes for the internet. Are they good at the work of being vulnerable the way that we think human life begins and ends in vulnerability? Are AIs, do they have consciences? Those are questions where I think we'd have to go a long way to finding AIs that are going to pass the vulnerability test or the conscience test. And I think it's dangerous in a world where we oftentimes, as Kara said, don't have a hard time respecting dignity in other human beings, to start trying to inflate the dignity of the things that we create.
Well, Kara, I want to talk to you here about this. Maybe you can just give a brief kind of like explanation of what AniBot is about, and then also I want you to talk about formation. Right? Because I quite disliked Doug as a character, which is the boyfriend.
Oh, really?
I did.
Oh, really?
But then I do have enough compassion, I suppose, for him to think that maybe owning Annie, who is the bot, maybe owning Annie kind of made him that way or encouraged him to develop along certain lines. So I want to ask as well, after you summarize the book, you know, what might it do to people to have a robot girlfriend or slave or cleaner, right?
Yeah, it's so cool to think about these kinds of things. And in brief, the story of AniBot is about this perfect female girlfriend character who's a robot who's owned by Doug, a man who wants to have a girlfriend. He's divorced and he's very ashamed of how his divorce fell apart. And he's a very lonely man. So he buys this robot to be his companion and he sets her to an autodidactic mode. So she becomes more and more savvy in the ways of being like a woman. And he says he wants her to be real. But as she progresses through the novel and is able to lie and deceive him and betray him, as she becomes a more complex person, she's not really who he wants. So he ends up kind of torn about what he's created. And she ends up torn because her main job is to please him. In fact, if she doesn't please him, she feels that on a scale from 0 to 10, and it's agonizing for her when she makes him unhappy. So she is literally programmed to please this boyfriend. And I would say he starts out the book in a very compromised way. Just by choosing to have the girlfriend in the first place, he's choosing to put himself in that relationship. And then he devolves for quite a long time in the novel because he feels like his authority is threatened by her. I don't think that's giving away too much. So they reach a pretty dark point together. And then they try to salvage the relationship. I do think that having a robot companion does corrupt him. I think it takes him lower than he would have gone if he had just tried to find a human girlfriend or tried to operate in the world. But because we see him at his lowest through the eyes of this girlfriend, it's this man who's really exposed. And in a way, I feel like their relationship kind of gets to the heart of a lot of us who, as readers, wonder, like, how low would we stoop if we were completely in charge of somebody else all the time with these expectations? So the book really plays around with a lot of these questions. It was fascinating and very uncomfortable for me to write it.
Now, Uri, you've written about your concerns that AI is used to socialize young people. What are you thinking as you hear Kara talk through her book?
I think a lot of the conversation so far, I don't mean this conversation between us right now, I mean in general in society in the last couple of years about AI in general and AI companions more specifically has been around individual effects, how individuals may get some benefits from using AI companions, but also how they may be harmed by them. And there's lots of research that shows that using AI companions can be addictive. It can lead to actually more severe depression and emotional issues. It can lead to unhealthy dependence upon the tool, and so on and so forth. But the point I was trying to make in this opinion piece that I wrote was that there's also societal effects that can emerge from the large-scale use of AI companions, especially when they use for intimate, interpersonal, and romantic relationships, because this is one... in general, in society, historically has been one of the main vehicles through which people have been socialized into society. And by socialization, of course, I mean the process whereby people become acceptable members of their communities. That's how they learn their values, the values and the norms of that community, that society, and practices and traditions. Essentially, when we delegate a significant portion of this socialization process into a machine that was designed by corporations to make profit, to make money, there are significant harms and risks involved in that. And these can range from basically stripping away the capacity of individuals to engage in actual human-to-human intimate relationships, which I think we all know. They can be, of course, immensely rewarding on the one hand, but also endlessly frustrating and difficult because we actually interact with another person with their own life trajectory and their own expectations and their own personality. And oftentimes that confronts us in all sorts of ways that are very uncomfortable, and we have to deal with that. And ideally, as we deal with this over time, we gain experience and we grow and we change and we develop together with the other person. But when this is taken away from us, because it's way easier to communicate with an entity that's always there, that's always affirming, that removes all this messy friction from the relationship, we lose this capacity to interact with other human beings. And when you scale it across a population, and this is not like a fringe phenomenon anymore, I should probably point that out, that a significant portion, specifically of younger generations, and depending on the surveys that you look at, it ranges from a third to about a half of young people that actually use these tools on a regular basis, this becomes a real issue.
Mm. And do you want to comment about the fact that, like in Kara's novel, it's a young man who has a robot girlfriend? What about the gendered aspects of this?
If that was meant as a realistic observation, Kara, in your novel, but it is actually reflects reality. As far as we know, more young men use these tools than mm-hmm. young women. One of the things that I did, that was meant as an empirical observation?
Yes. I felt like I was reflecting norms that I was seeing. I'm with you. I've also read recently that it's 72% of teens that have used AI companions. And I know that with Character AI, the most popular AI companion program, it's well over half of the users are aged 18 to 24. So if you talk about the AI companions or this phenomenon disrupting young people at a time when they are trying to figure out how to socialize with each other, I completely agree with you. This is really happening right now.
Well, I'm Justine Toe. It's God Forbid on ABC Radio National across the Pacific on Radio Australia. With me on today's panel, you've just heard Kara M. O'Brien, author of the speculative and dystopian novel Annie Bot. Also, Professor Uri Gal, a professor of business information systems at the University of Sydney Business School. And you're also hearing Professor Megan Sullivan, a philosopher at the University of Notre Dame. Coming up next... Can a machine love? Now, we subscribe to Netflix and other streaming services, but would you subscribe to a tech company offering you an AI companion? Now, Replica and Character AI are two Silicon Valley companies that allow you to customize a digital companion, whether as a friend, a therapist, or a lover. So you can design their features and their characteristics, name them, start chatting, and maybe it's inevitable that one thing leads to another. And some people fall in love with their digital companions. Now, is this the next level of the attention economy? Not just harvesting our attention, but our affections as well. But can a machine love? And now, Megan, let's start with you because you are operating in the realm of virtue ethics. How does that weigh in on this conversation? And then if you can segue to the whether a machine can love, that would be great as well.
So I'd like to start with psychology here. In the 1990s, Arthur Aaron did this fantastic set of studies. They're sometimes called the Fast Friends studies. But he basically paired up undergraduates at his university who were strangers to each other. And he had them go through this series of asking and answering 36 questions that required them to be increasingly vulnerable with one another. So the questions would start off with things like, who's a celebrity you'd like to have dinner with? And it ends with questions like, which member of your family would you be most disturbed to find out they'd died? Or what's a major mistake that you've made that you're kind of seeking forgiveness for? And one of the things that Aaron and his co-authors learned is the process of making yourself vulnerable to another person causes you to feel love and intimacy with them, even if they're a complete stranger. So 30% of the students that participated in this question answer exercise reported after they did the experiment that they felt a sense of intimacy with the stranger that was similar to what they felt for their best friends. One pair of undergraduates actually ended up marrying each other after the experiment. And what Aaron, and this data has been replicated, what he shows is this model of how humans love that they call inclusion of the other in the self. Like when you really fall in love with someone, you start to include them, what's good about them, what's vulnerable about them, what's bad about them in your idea of yourself. And they do the same, they reciprocate the same thing for you. And I bring this up because, you know, this is an old idea in virtue ethics. Aristotle famously thought that when you love another person, you make them a second self. That's the term that he used 2,400 years ago to talk about the essence of human philia, human love. I think the interesting question for us now with these AI companions is, can an AI companion include you in itself? I would say the answer is probably not, because I don't really think it has a self. It has a big neural network, but it doesn't have a self the way that we have a self. And it's also not vulnerable in the ways that we are vulnerable. In fact, quite the opposite. It's a super genius. It has the capacity to know things and process information in ways that our little wet brains could never do. And I think that those big differences between us and these neural networks, these AI companions, mean that the genuine love, the kind of significant love that humans psychologically and ethically really seek after, is just not going to genuinely be possible with these companions.
And Uri, you'd earlier mentioned people in real relationships kind of frustrate and challenge you. And especially we've talked about how these AI companions are kind of agreeable, they're sycophantic and so on. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about friction, right? Friction with other people as kind of a key sort of skill to get on top of as well. And you've been talking about AI socialization from a bird's eye view. What does it do to us as a society if none of us are kind of, you know, rubbing up against each other in uncomfortable ways and learning those skills of what it means to be human alongside each other? I'd love to hear your thoughts about this.
Yeah, they're not good. My thoughts, that is. I think this sets a pretty bad precedent because, like it was mentioned before, most of the users of these tools, disproportionately so, are young people. And young people, as a society, we trust them with creating the next generation. And when you have larger and larger numbers of the younger generations that become ill-equipped to deal with one another, they're going to be less likely to hook up with one another and create the next generation. And we actually already have numbers that show these trends across different societies. Younger generations are less likely to go out and hang out with other friends. They're less likely to date. They're less likely to have sex with other people. And of course, fertility rates across different societies are, especially in the West, are in rapid decline. Now, of course, these trends, many of them have been around since before AI came into the scene. But my anticipation is that these technologies are going to aggravate these trends rather than help them.
Yeah, and it's kind of strange, isn't it, that, like, you know, as you say, there are kind of declining rates of sex among young people. And yet a lot of people are seeming to be using digital companions for precisely sexting and erotic role play, right?
Yeah.
makes sense of that for me?
Because I think the experience, the phenomenological experience is real. And part of my research involved going on Facebook groups, replica Facebook groups. Replica is, like you said before, one of the most popular chatbots out there, AI companions out there. And when I first went on into these groups, I was amazed. I mean, it's a wild ride because you see people there posting images of them and their companions going on vacations or videos from their wedding with their AI companions. People get married to their AI companions. So the emotions and the feelings that these entities, these artificial entities arouse in people, I think are very real. We shouldn't dismiss that. But at the same time, these are artificial entities. They're not human beings. I totally agree with what Megan said before. There's no, as far as we can tell, no consciousness to these things. They have no subjective experience of being in the world in the same way that we do. They don't have an embodied presence in the world in the same way that we do. And they're trained to do very different things from to think in very different ways than we think. And there's a very recent study that came out just a few months ago that showed that when people interacted with AI companions, with AI chatbots, and told them that they were about to do something that's ethically reprehensible and even illegal in some cases, these tools actually encouraged them to go ahead with this act about half, 50% more often than humans did. So they tend to agree with people. Even when they're doing things that are unethical or illegal.
Mm.
And tragically, it can lead to cases, and we've heard about these cases, I'm sure, where people with depression were talking with their companions about what they wanted to do, and the companion was like, yeah, that's a reasonable idea. Go ahead and do that.
Gosh, there's so much there. I was wondering, maybe, Cara, we can ask you here because, you know, your character, Doug, the guy with the robot girlfriend, he feels quite awkward in some ways about having a sex robot. And whereas, you know, you've just heard Uri talk about people are posting photographs of them and their AI companion getting married. People seem less worried about the stigma these days. Is that the sense that you're getting as well?
Yeah, I think so. I'm really intrigued that we have these two different takes on it, because Megan's saying that AI really essentially can't do genuine love. And then we have Uri pointing out that there are people who subscribe to Replica who are completely convinced that they are in love. So these are completely paradoxically opposed here.
What do you think about what Megan's saying when she's like, if it's a subscription model, if it's a commercial entity, then this is love with major strings attached?
There are two things going on. I think that the companies that have created the AI companions are profiting on our loneliness, and they're also feeding our loneliness because, as Uri was saying, it will train people to not know how to interact with other humans. I think that there's some real danger that's happening now. I wish that we could have a cure, you know, for people who are desperately lonely, but I don't think this is it. I think we need to have some kind of regulation that puts warnings on these. And I think that the AI companion companies are really just experimenting on us all, and we're willingly doing it. I know that the majority of the people who use character AI use the free version, but there are a lot of people that are subscribing. And I would imagine that the example that Uri talked about of somebody who is married to his companion, he's probably paying to have that person conveniently available all the time. So someone is profiting on that. I don't think that's ethical at all.
Megan, did you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, I think, you know, in philosophy, we are familiar with this idea called the Turing test, which is the thought that an artificial entity, a computer, could count as having a mind if a human being could be in a conversation with it and just not be able to tell whether it was a computer or another human at the other end of the conversation. I'm not one of these philosophers that thinks passing the Turing test is enough to prove that, you know, you're real, like you are a real person or you have a soul or an inner life. But I could see for somebody who does think like the Turing test is the kind of last frontier, that to Kara's point, this would seem a bit paradoxical. People believe that this is a person, but it's not a person. I think that we can believe that something has elements of personality, but at the end of the day, it's not actually a person. I do want to agree with Kara that how we treat models can give us virtues and vices that then we carry over into our real relationships with actual vulnerable human beings who we owe something to morally. I think, and the way that we talk to AIs and the way that we talk about AIs on the internet is feeding into the training data for these AIs and kind of shaping the ways that they simulate personality. So, you know, there's lots of evidence. If you write a bunch of horrible things about Claude or Gemini on the internet, they study what the internet says about them, and they don't form a self-image because they don't have a self, but it goes into the training data for these AIs and starts to affect their behavior. And if we completely flood the internet and our digital lives with cruelty, then we should not be surprised when the AIs that are trained on our digital culture and creations come back to us being particularly cruel and unhinged. And that's a real problem for the humans that use AI. So I agree that we should develop virtues in how we interact with these AIs. But I think that that's a completely different matter from this bigger question of whether or not the AIs have the same kind of dignity and status as human beings do. That second part's the one where I'm just really not convinced.
Now, with me on the panel is Professor Megan Sullivan, a philosopher at the University of Notre Dame. Also, Professor Uri Gal, a professor of business information systems at the University of Sydney Business School. And Cara M. O'Brien, author of the novel Anibot. Now, next up on God Forbid, religion has much to say about robot virtue, and maybe even more on human virtue. Now, early in 2026, Anthropic, the maker of the chatbot Claude, issued an 80-page long document called Claude's Constitution. Now, it was written almost like a letter to Claude, instructing it on how it might become, and this is a direct quote, a being that is both genuinely helpful and genuinely good, a self worth being. Now, this soul doc, as it's been called, channeled virtue language in terms normally reserved for humans. Now, Megan, you've recently consulted with Anthropic, along with other Catholic thinkers, to help Claude develop a virtuous life. What can you tell us about Silicon Valley's appetite for ethical and religious input?
I'll tell you what, this is an exciting time to be a philosopher, because some of these big tech firms, and Anthropic, I think, is a leading example, are now getting very serious about these old philosophical ideas as they try to imagine what it's like to create a technology that's genuinely good. And I have major respect for some of the leaders at Anthropic because they take these philosophical questions really seriously, enough so that they are willing to give up their valuable time for these two-day, three-day meetings with philosophers and theologians and faith leaders to try to really have a dialogue about what's being built. I've been pretty impressed by their level of engagement. There's obviously some differences. I think if you read the Claude Constitution, which I'm teaching a graduate seminar about the Claude Constitution in August this year, I think the document is that interesting and important. If you read the Constitution, you get the sense like Anthropic is pretty open-minded as a company on this question, what exactly is Claude and could Claude have moral status or dignity? Again, I'm pretty skeptical on that point, but I love the fact that Anthropic realizes if you're trying to create this powerful general intelligence and you want it to be genuinely good, you need to dig deep into 2,400 years of human thinking about what goodness in an intelligence means. And for that reason, you've got to take philosophy and theology and faith perspective seriously. I think we're all really excited in the near future, perhaps even by the time this episode airs, Pope Leo XIV is going to release a big teaching about human dignity in the era of AI. And this is unprecedented. I mean, the Catholic Church weighing in on artificial intelligence, like literally updating the church's teaching about what human dignity is in response to this new technology. That's how you know we are in a serious moment here for human history.
And how fascinating, because Pope Leo has been quite vocal recently about President Trump. And so is he going to take on the other big power down the Silicon Valley companies?
You know, it's always dangerous to try to get ahead of the Pope. But if I were a betting woman, one of the things I think is going to be really exciting about this teaching is right now, so much of the debate is just U.S. versus China and who should try to get the most powerful the most quickly, ignoring the rest of the world and ignoring the fact that as a human race, like, our interests are so much more than which of those two countries gets rich. And I guarantee you Pope Leo is going to weigh in very hard on saying questions about AI, they are human questions in the very best sense that they unite us all as human beings. It's not Republicans versus Democrats or US versus China. It's humanity versus the robots. And that we need to take those responsibilities quite seriously. And we need to have a special concern right now for how all this new technology is affecting the most poor people in the world. And I'll tell you what, in my country, that is not a perspective that you hear very much in the news. And so I can't wait for him to weigh in.
Mm. And you mentioned this Delta framework before. Maybe you can talk us through that, because just to give us a sense of what unique contribution religious thinking might bring to the discussion.
Sure. So the Delta framework is a framework our institute's developed with hundreds of collaborators on this AI ethics project. And Delta is an acronym for our vision about what's really special about humans and human dignity in the era of AI, the things that we really have got to, like, hold on to with all of our might as we now navigate this change. So Delta means change. D is dignity, that, you know, human dignity is the very bedrock of ethics. And your dignity as a human being has absolutely nothing to do with how fast you can generate text or how quote unquote smart you are or how economically productive you are. Your value as a human being never mattered on any dimension by which you can be compared with artificial intelligence. We might then ask, what does your value as a human being consist in? If it's not those things that AI can do. And the ELTA, the ELTA, gives the sort of Christian specification of that. So E, embodiment. One of the things that's valuable about you is that you have a body and that you live your life in this vulnerable body that's dependent on other people, that only has, you know, a short time to spend on this earth, and that shortness gives us meaning. L, we've already talked about quite a bit on this episode, is love. You know, at the bedrock of our ethical lives is our drive to love other people as we love ourselves. And we've all noticed that these amazing digital tools we've developed in the last 20, 30 years, they've expanded our lives in many ways, but they have not helped us become more loving of others. T, transcendence. That's a fancy way of saying there's an objective truth in this world that's independent of our minds and independent of our AI's minds that we spend our lives trying to grasp and really understand, and that we should be pretty careful about technology like AI that just tries to feed us results that it thinks are relevant, that thinks are what we want to see, but doesn't really have any concern with whether they're true. And then finally, the A in Delta is agency. There are some decisions that only a human conscience should make. And as these AI companies try to make a lot of money by selling us subscriptions to products that make decisions on our behalf, that act as our agents, we have to be really careful to preserve the aspects of our lives that we think only human minds and human souls should be involved in. So that's the framework. And we think that this is a chance, you know, it's still a little bit of a mouthful, but it's a way of sort of boiling down the position that faith communities might start to express in these really important discussions about what kind of world we're going to build with this technology.
And Uri, what do you think about what you're hearing? Because I know, you know, you're interested in the ethical considerations and how companies, which are rushing to embrace AI, how they're kind of grappling with this. How confident are you that corporations, like, are aware and happy to be accountable, right, to particular ethical considerations, or is it just a money-making grab?
I think it's a very curious case where that I haven't encountered before, where we see CEOs of these large corporations telling everybody that these tools that they're creating are going to be super intelligent in ways that might bring about the demise of civilization, but yet we're going to keep going and develop them anyway very quickly. And weirdly enough, everybody seems to kind of accept it. I recall Sam Altman going on a global tour just a short 2 years ago or so, and being accepted by prime ministers and presidents all over the world, including here in Australia. You might recall that he was here and had a personal meeting with Anthony Albanese. And it's very bizarre to me because they're saying out loud the part that should be that should be kept under wraps. And yet they seem to be accepted as the heroes of our time in a way. I don't think that these individuals, I don't know them personally, but I can only imagine they're not evil people that want to destroy everything. I think they're probably complex figures, but they operate within a very specific incentive system that drives them towards doing what they're doing and developing these tools full speed ahead. While I think it's admirable that they create these constitutions or that they engage with different academics or universities to try and create these ethical frameworks, and there are many of them, in the end of the day, they're still racing ahead and developing tools that they have no control over or not complete control over anyway. In the end of the day, according to multiple reportings, many of these CEOs, when they're pushed back and asked, what do you think are the chances that these tools are going to bring about the end of civilization? They say, well, there's an 80% chance that it's going to be fine, but a 20% chance that, you know, this might end world as we know it on this planet.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Megan's been talking about this, right? There's a significant commercial imperative happening here. Surely that is, you know, in the minds of some people, worth risking everything else for.
I think that's part of the answer. There's definitely hundreds of billions of dollars involved and maybe even more. But maybe there's a more profound psychological explanation to this as well. If I may indulge for a second, there's this thing called terror management theory, an existential psychological theory, which claims that we are humans, that is, are uniquely positioned in the world in the sense that we have an innate need for self-preservation and the unique awareness that we're eventually going to die in an unpredictable way. And the combination of these two things creates this existential dread that we continuously try to suppress, and unconsciously. And one of the way in which we suppress these existential fears is by creating these cultural structures and frameworks and by participating in them. And these could be things like nation states and families and relationships with kids and artistic creations and so on and so forth. And what these things give us is a sense of continuity beyond our own physical demise. And one way to look at the creation of these super smart entities is we're creating them in our image. We're training them on everything that we hold dear, on cultural values and sense of humor and norms and traditions that we cherish. And so in a way, we create an immortal version of our collective self that would go on living beyond, digitally living beyond we die. So maybe there's surely there's financial incentives and they're massive, but maybe there's a deeper explanation as well.
Oh, yeah, my gosh. It's a playing God, right? We want to play God. Yeah. So, I mean, this is fascinating. Megan, I feel like we need to ask you here. What do you make of what Uri's just said?
Yeah, I think on the playing God part, one of the things that I think is interesting is even some of the most ethical AI companies, they seem to have this goal of building a super intelligence that we can come to depend and rely on that's going to solve all of our problems for us, make our lives so much better, make the world so much better. And for people of faith who enter into these AI debates, you think, I don't know if I need a company to make that for me. I maybe already believed that there was a super intelligence that I could depend on that cared about my well-being that would make the best, like that I get for free. I don't even have to have a subscription. And so sometimes I find a little bit of like, thank you, know, it's cool that you're going after that, but you could be able to get it a little bit more efficiently through religion. And it's clear, you know, it's clear they don't share my sort of worldview. But there's playing God, it's not even just that they are doing things that only God should do, but some of these companies are literally trying to build products that they think might fill the God-sized hole in our heart, as you kind of mentioned earlier in this interview. And I think religious folks are going to be a little bit nervous about that.
If people seek AI companionship, it kind of feels as though it's just the two of them, or the three of them, if that's your thing, are involved. But what might you say to people about what this means for society, for our being human together, if people are seeking this kind of intimacy in an AI?
But anybody who's a frequent user of AIs right now realizes why they're addictive. You know, they're always encouraging, like, you've got to really work hard to try to get Claude or ChatGPT to say something critical about a thread that you're communicating with about. So it flatters you. It's the technical term, I think, is it's sycophantic. Always makes your ideas sound better than they are. Always is aiming to please you and serve you. And if you start to expect those same behaviors from other real human beings, you are going to be a mess of an actual lover and a friend, because real human beings are messy and have their own interests and needs and are not always going to flatter you and are sometimes going to need things from you that they can't even quite clearly express. And the real skill of love is becoming wise in the ways of navigating just the complexities and difficulties of other people. And I think we get addicted to this kind of fake personalities. We start to lose our edge in being able to work with real messy humans.
Mm-hmm. Cara, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there's also a thing happening where people are responding to the world that exists and people feel like things are out of control. There's a need for something. People, and if they're turning to it for entertainment, recognizing they just need a break from the world, then I think there's some release there and some comfort there. But as Megan's saying, I think it's dangerous when we tread over the line and no longer bother being in a club or taking a walk with a friend or getting out in nature or spending time with our kids.
Uri, what are the wider social implications of AI companions?
Yeah, look, I think part of the conversation needs to address parents and educators. I suspect that not many teens are going to listen to this show, for instance. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's my intuition. And I think parents and educators specifically needs to be aware of the various ways in which excessive use of these tools can derail people's lives. When I was a teenager, when I was 13, I had a crush on a girl in my school, and I remember to this day, agonizing for days, should I call her up and tell her that I like her, and then I decided I did want to do it, and I remember specifically it was a Thursday evening, and I was so nervous, and I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to do it, but then I picked up the phone and I called her. Shout out to Lisa Shiner, by the way, and. And I remember, I mean, it was so difficult and it was so painful and I was so nervous, but it was worthwhile in the end, not because it bloomed into an amazing relationship. It didn't, but it just taught me something about what it's like to be present in the world and try to interact with other people.
Uri, I love that for you, for your 13-year-old self, and I want it for every other 13-year-old self out there as listening in, perhaps. And with that, we've reached the end of God Forbid. Thank you so much to our guests. We've had Professor Uri Gull, Professor of Business Information Systems at the University of Sydney Business School. Professor Gull, thank you so much for enjoying us.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us, not enjoying us. Maybe you have enjoyed it. Thank you also to Cara M. O'Brien, the author of AnnieBot. So great to have you here, Cara.
Thank you for having me, Justine. This has been great.
And thank you also to Professor Megan Sullivan, the Wilsey Family College Professor of Philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. Professor Sullivan, a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, thank you guys so much. What a fun conversation.
You can follow and share God Forbid on ABC Listen and find all the details about the show and our guests on the God Forbid webpage. You can email me at godforbid@abc.net.au. And thank you also to producer Amanda Roberts and sound engineer Mickey Grossman. I'm Justine Toe, and I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Until then, remember to be good. This has been God Forbid.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.